We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. For many people, climate change really means bad weather, certainly extreme weather events. Our guest for this hour, Christian Peretti, says that more often it appears as ethnic or religious violence, as criminal mayhem or civil war. This morning in this hour of Focus, Christian Peretti, who is contributing editor at The Nation, will be talking with us about some of the ideas you will find in his recently published book. The title is Tropic of Chaos, and the subtitle, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. It is published by Nation Books. And in this book, he takes a look at conditions in a number of places, and these largely are post-colonial states, which happen to be along the mid-latitudes of the planet. So these are places that have really suffered the brunt of rough weather. And he makes the argument that if you scratch the surface of many contemporary conflicts, what you will find is a climate angle. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. Christian Peretti is contributing editor at The Nation. He's a Puffin Foundation writing fellow at The Nation Institute, visiting scholar at the City University of New York. He's the author of a number of other books, Lockdown America, The Soft Cage, and The Freedom. He's also written for a number of publications, among them Fortune, New York Times, LA Times, Washington Post, Mother Jones, the London Review of Books. He's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome. We hope people will be brief and be on target, but if you can do that, your questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, you may do that as well. Will-talk is the address. And Christian Peretti, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much. Well, thanks for talking with us. You know, I think here the argument that you're making is subtle, or maybe the effect is subtle, because what you're arguing is that climate change, as far as conflict is concerned, is kind of an accelerant, that it makes existing social problems worse. And so what you get, and there are a number of things, and we'll talk about how they all come together, but what you get is a kind of cascading effect, I think, as these various factors pile up. The end result, the kind of conflict that we've seen many places around the world, and you might, at first, when you look at that, you might say, well, I don't exactly see how that can be related to climate or related to weather. But if you step back through it a little bit, you actually can see those connections.
Right. I am not arguing that climate change is ever the sole cause of violence, but that it acts as an accelerant and that it acts through pre-existing crises, and it is thus masked, and that the connection between violence and climate change may be attenuated and displaced, but it is very real and very concretely traceable. And it plays out differently in different places, and that's why the book is structured in the form of case studies to some extent. But so the argument in a nutshell is that climate change arrives in the global south on a stage preset for crisis, that many societies in the global south are in a position that makes them susceptible or vulnerable to the weather shocks in the form of drought and flooding that are now unfolding and that are linked to the pattern that scientists have predicted for many decades will be produced by global warming. And just as a caveat, I mean, scientists don't argue that this tornado or that drought are directly linked to climate change. That level of specificity and causality is not possible. But what is very clear is that there's a pattern of increased burning of fossil fuels leading to increased CO2 emissions, which traps more heat in the planet, which leads to disruption and an unraveling of the climatological system, which is expressed as increased drought, increased flooding, and disruption of major weather patterns such as the monsoons or the intertropical convergence zone, which is the precipitation belt that moves north and south between the Tropic of Capricorn Tropical Cancer and governs the rain patterns in most of the equatorial regions of the planet. So the book opens, for example, in the Horn of Africa, where we now have this famine, which is caused by a drought. And the drought is very clearly linked to climate change. The situation in northern Kenya on the border with Somalia is, even before this crisis, was very violent. And this cattle herders, pastoralists, have increasingly taken to raiding each other's animals and fighting over the few remaining water holes. The region is in a devastatingly bad drought, and that is compounded by the pre-existing crises of Cold War-era militarism, which, in a nutshell, flooded the region with cheap weapons and undermined state capacity and good governance. The ultimate example of that being the collapse of Somalia, where there's no governance and no state to speak of outside of a little part of Mogadishu. And then the other aspect is economic neoliberalism, the embrace of radical free market economics that hold that the government should withdraw itself from economic activity. So in Kenya, that means the state has pulled back on well drilling programs, on veterinary extension programs, on road building, on direct aid to pastoralists. And so the book opens with this guy named Ekru Lorman, who had been killed and is lying at my feet, killed in a cattle raid, and I try and unpack what caused his death. And it's really all of these things. The cheap weaponry left over from the Cold War. The Horn of Africa was a site for hot proxy battles as part of the Cold War, with the Soviet Union and Cuba supporting Ethiopia, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan supporting Somalia, leading to the collapse of Somalia. And then the fact that so Ekru Lorman has, you know, one of the hand-me-down weapons from that conflict, and as did his adversaries, the Pequot, who came to raid his cattle. Why were they fighting over this one little borehole? Because there weren't enough, because the Kenyan government had withdrawn systematically its support for pastoralists. And so in the face of the drought, this devastating drought that was desiccating the landscape and making it impossible for the animals to find food, and the herds thus were falling sick, in the face of that, the pastoralists fall back on the only means they had at hand, which were cheap weapons. And so there's an increase in the cattle raiding. It becomes more and more violent. It moves beyond just cattle raiding into raiding passenger traffic. All the buses in northwest Kenya travel with armed guards. The police are up there. That's the one main government response. And the paramilitary police, who look like soldiers, who wear camouflage and carry machine guns and are supported by helicopters, go after the raiding parties. The Ugandan and Kenyan military are occasionally crossing each other's borders. And there's a situation driven by climate change, pressed through these other pre-existing crises of the legacy of Cold War militarism and the economic rollback of neoliberalism, that has left the region in a state of warfare, intercommunal warfare over resources, and with a layer of haphazard state repression on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, at first glance, that doesn't necessarily look like climate change, and it's not climate change alone that's driving the violence. But if you unpack the history, you can see that climate change is working through other pre-existing problems to really turn them into outright crises.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting. You have explained that you actually started thinking about this, the beginnings of this project that ends up being Tropic of Chaos, when you were in Afghanistan and you were writing about the business of growing poppies, which then ends up eventually being turned into heroin. And you went there and you asked people who were growing the poppies, well, why are you doing this? What did they tell you?
Yeah, again and again, they say, well, one reason we do this is because poppy is very drought resistant. And I did a number of stories on this over a course of, you know, several years. And at first, when I was doing this reporting in 2004, 2005, I didn't even know there was a drought in Afghanistan. Turns out Afghanistan is living through the worst drought in living memory that has coincided with the whole NATO nation-building project there. And the Afghan government, such as it is, and the NATO forces attack poppy. They want to eradicate poppy. The Taliban support the farmers' right to grow poppy. And so I was trying to find out why they take these risks to grow poppy rather than other things. And lo and behold, there's a drought, and poppy is drought resistant. Turns out poppy uses one-fifth to one-sixth the amount of water that wheat uses. So in the face of this devastating drought, poppy, this outlaw crop, is actually the only crop that's really economically feasible because there isn't enough water. And there's one side in the war, the Taliban, who support the farmers' right to grow this crop. So it became clear that, not that the war was driven by climate change or this drought, but that that was a precipitating factor, it was a contributing factor in helping to explain why there was an endless flow of young men ready to fight for the Taliban. Just one factor in it is that the Taliban support the farmers' right to grow the only crop that actually makes any economic sense given the drought, because it uses one-fifth to one-sixth the water that wheat uses. Meanwhile, you know, putting aside the question of corruption, the incredible corruption of the Karzai government, even when there isn't corruption, the alternative livelihood programs being promulgated by USAID and, you know, Britain's equivalent DFID, I mean, those things in the face of the climate crisis don't really work. Farmers can't really grow wheat. They can't grow apricots and survive given the crisis. So it helped explain a little bit why there's this endless line of young men willing to fight for the Taliban. And one thing, because a lot of people heard this, there's some confusion about the Taliban's position on poppy. The Taliban government allowed people to grow poppy. One year, it was 1999 to 2000, they, in exchange for about $40 million of eradication aid from the West, imposed a ban on growing poppy. But all the other time they were in power, they allowed poppy growing, and as an insurgent movement, they have always defended poppy. So there's some confusion about that, because they did, in fact, one year say, okay, no more poppy, but it was only one year, and that is not their entire policy on poppy. Mm-hmm. Primarily, they defend it.
So what we come away with, it gives one something to think about, is here we have a conflict that we have seen primarily in political terms, people fighting over competing ideologies, political and religious. And while though you can't take those things out of the equation, this makes you look at it in at least a little bit different way.
Yes. Climate change is the gasoline on the fire. Mm-hmm. Just north of Afghanistan, there's an example which is equally kind of attenuated, but it's actually more dramatic in its illustration, which is Kyrgyzstan. In the spring of 2010, people might remember that Kyrgyzstan exploded in ethnic rioting, Kyrgyz versus Uzbeks. The capital, Bishkek, went up in flames. One government collapsed. Another government came in. The new government called for Russian intervention. The Russians very wisely declined. And it looked like, you know, just pogroms between Uzbeks and Kyrgyz. And this time around, the Uzbeks were getting the worst of it, though they in the past had done their fair share of dishing. And you know, just looked like ethnic hatred. But drill into the story, and this is the chain of causality that I found. Kyrgyzstan is a country that gets 90% of its electricity from hydroelectric, particularly one major old Soviet-built hydroelectric dam. The same drought that has punished Afghanistan over the last 10 years caused the water levels in the Toktola Dam to drop to their lowest level ever. It's the main dam. That caused the government to have to start rationing power. Once it started rationing electricity, industry had to lay people off and couldn't operate very efficiently or around the clock. With increased unemployment comes decreased consumer demand, which then feeds back and increases even more the unemployment. So there's rising unemployment, power rationing. Then on top of that, in the winter of 2009, comes this devastating the cold winter, freak cold snap where temperatures are twice as low as normal. Pipes in apartment buildings are exploding as the water in them freezes. Pensioners froze to death. School was closed down and most industry for 2 months. Cattle herds died. So also there's, at, during that, of course, increased demand for power, both in Kyrgyzstan and in the region, and the corrupt government officials are pirating power off to neighboring states. So the power crisis and the economic crisis gets even worse. Then on top of that, the president decides he wants to privatize the utility system, that he's going to reengage with a stalled-out program of economic liberalization, of moving towards radical free market economics. So to make the assets of the utility system more attractive, he doubles the power tariffs, the rates people pay for their electricity, with a promise to double them at least again. And it's at that point, early spring of 2010, that people hit the streets. And it's an economic protest about the cost of living and high unemployment. And the unemployed, you know, a lot of them are young men who spend their time in casinos drinking and getting angry and hanging out with fellow Uzbeks or fellow Kyrgyz. So these protests about economic conditions then rather quickly devolve into ethnic clashes led by these lumpenized, unemployed, angry young men. And that leads to the collapse of the government and the violence. And so you can see that beneath this ethnic conflict is an economic crisis, beneath which lies an environmental, climatologically driven crisis expressed as the intense drought punctuated by the horribly cold winter. And the combination of these things have triggered this ethnic conflict.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Christian Peretti. He's contributing editor at The Nation. He is also visiting scholar at City University of New York, is author of the recent book Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence, and it's published by Nation Books. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And I think it's very interesting and challenging argument, something really worth thinking about. And I think it brings home the idea that so much of these things that we've seen around the world that we label ethnic religious conflicts are really conflicts over resources. They may not all be tied to something like climate, but certainly there is this connection. If there's a place where there's terrific pressure on the resources that makes it difficult for people to survive, and if their governments have pulled back and are not providing any kind of support to help them survive, then people are basically thrown back on their own resources, and it should not be surprising that whatever resources there are, people are going to fight over them, because in a lot of places it really comes down to a matter of whether you're going to survive or not.
That's right. I mean, the model of resource wars is very typically in academic literature used to discuss conflict between states. And I mean, what I'm discussing primarily is internal conflict. And the Pentagon, the armed services of the United States, sort of see things in a similar fashion. They, to their credit, take the science very seriously, unlike many in the American political class. They rely on the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the UN's main clearinghouse for vetting climate science. And that means, you know, actual climate science, studying the climate system, and then all the scientific disciplines that feed into it, biology, oceanography, forestry. And the IPCC vets this and comes out every 4 years with a report designed to help governments understand the problem and create policies to address climate change. And the Pentagon uses the IPCC's findings and does not question that science. And what they see running their scenarios based on IPCC findings is that, you know, they project a future of increased internal conflict, increased religious warfare, ethnic clashes, mass migration, increased natural disaster and humanitarian crisis, and civil war and counterinsurgency. And they realize that the armed services are going to be called upon to respond to this. And less likely in the scenario is wars over water between states or stuff like that, but rather internal conflicts. And they realize they're going to have to respond, and so that puts front and center low-intensity conflict, counterinsurgency, counterterror, humanitarian interventions. This is becoming the sort of central focus of their military planning. And I'm critical of that. I mean, I don't expect the military to do anything differently. It's it only has a certain set of tools at its disposal. It is the military, so its response to problems is military. And even the military, to its credit, ends many of these reports by saying, we can keep a lid on this crisis up to a certain point, but after a certain point, if there is no mitigation, if there's no reduction in carbon emissions, there's very little that a military response can do. And so there has to be a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, and a transformation of the economy is the real solution. But in the short term, they're planning for an armed response to increased chaos in the global south.
Yeah. And I think this is a very striking point, because here in the United States, this conversation over global climate change has become highly politicized to the extent that it is seen as the liberal position that you believe climate change is real and something ought to be done about it, and it's seen as the conservative position that, well, you know, climate goes through cycles, it gets hot, it gets cold, that we don't really have a problem here, and it would certainly be dangerous for the economy if we tried to do some of the things that have been proposed. Having said all that, the Pentagon, hardly a bastion of liberalism, hardly a hotbed of liberalism, they believe that this is serious enough so that they're planning for the response to conflicts that are going to result.
Correct. I think that's something that people frequently ask, say, well, how should one argue with your conservative uncle who listens to Rush Limbaugh and doesn't believe in climate change? And, you know, I would point them to Pentagon reports, many of which are declassified and online, you know, and they take the science very seriously. And not only that, they also actually have a pretty reasonable position on the limits of military power to handle this in the long run. And one, part of my critique of a military response to climate change is that counterinsurgency has a devastating effect on the social fabric, because the object in counterinsurgency is the civilian society, not terrain. Typically, the government fighting an insurgency already controls the terrain, but it doesn't control the population. So the tactics of counterinsurgency involve relocation of people, turning people against one another, surveillance, torture, detention, small-scale tactics that really get at the social fabric, also very dangerously. And very typically, the establishment of civilian auxiliaries to support the government's project. And when the war is over and the cause is no longer burning, be it, you know, whatever, socialist revolution or religious revolution, jihad, whatever it is, and the counterinsurgency has wrapped up, what is left is a landscape littered with weapons, littered with men trained in the arts of smuggling, assassination, interrogation, traumatized populations that have been deracinated from their home terrains and their traditional livelihoods, now trying to live in urban slums or, you know, relocating somewhere. And all of that primes societies for crime and makes them less resilient and capable in the face of climate change. So in Central America, which I don't actually dwell on that much in the book, but it is a region that's being hammered by climate change, drought and flooding, hurricanes in particular. In countries like Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, which were the front lines of revolutionary warfare and counterinsurgency throughout much of the late 70s into the early 90s, the death toll, the murder rate, nowadays is often equal to the death toll during the war. But there's no two sides in the conflict. There's no cause. It's just a landscape littered with weapons and traumatized people and lots of young men trained in violence. Hmm. And that's a problem in and of itself, and it also sets societies up to not be able to deal with adaptation, which is to say dealing with the amount of climate change we're locked in for, nor capable of mitigation, moving away from burning fossil fuels towards developing a new energy infrastructure. Mm.
Well, certainly in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of coverage of violence on the U.S.-Mexico border related to the drug trade. Is it too far a stretch to try and make the same connection between that kind of violence and what's happening with climate?
I think that increasingly climate change plays a role in that. I mean, I think the primary upheaval in Mexican society is free trade, that NAFTA and the liberalization of the Mexican economy, the privatization of the collective land rights, the ejidos that were inherited from the revolution, the transformation of the Mexican economy has really is the main cause of disruption. But increasingly, there is a climatological factor. And in Juarez, I have a chapter on Juarez. And, you know, I met people who basically are climate refugees, people who had to leave their terrain because of drought, a fisherman who had to leave Michoacan because an El Nino event in the 1990s brought warm water up that created an algae bloom that drove away the fish. And then in the face of a bad season, because of an embrace of radical free market economics by the Mexican government, all the old supports from the Mexican Revolution for small fishermen had been removed, so he had to go into debt on the private market. He couldn't pay off his debts. He lost his boat. He migrates north to Las Cruces, New Mexico, works as a roofer for a while, then gets deported. And when I met him, he's sitting in Juarez on the south bank of the Rio Grande, looking north, trying to figure out how he's going to come up with money to hire a coyote to get him across the border so he can get his job back. And he's saying, you know, the only jobs around here are involved in the drug trade, and I don't want to get involved in that, but that's really like the only easy money around here is to carry something for somebody, be a lookout, get involved in the violence. So climate refugees and the economic dislocation associated with climate change in Mexico are a contributing factor increasingly in the crisis in northern Mexico. And, you know, I think one could do a lot more research than I did into that question. I know that there are, in northern Mexico particularly, there are like whole ranches and villages that have been abandoned because of the drought. And there's a major drought, worst drought in 60 years, is gripping the very region where there is this drug crisis. And so people, you know, people don't say, oh, I'm going to give up ranching and go into drugs. They say, wow, this is getting a little too difficult here, ranching. I think I'll move to the city and get a job in a factory or at a hotel. They arrive in the city and there is no such job, and one thing leads to another, and they become involved in the drug crisis. And then also then the drug crisis is tremendously undermining of state capacity. I mean, as is witnessed right now by the purges of the Mexican prosecutor's office and some police ranks in Mexico, you know, the drug trade has really corrupted the Mexican state. So the Mexican state is totally ineffective in its responses to the drug trade. And once there's a breakdown in law and order, then there's just, you know, a real free-for-all. So the violence now in Juarez is really, you know, I mean, can't actually even just be ascribed to drugs. It's drugs create a crisis of law and order and corruption. Corruption has made the state ineffective. In 2009, there were, I think, two murders prosecuted in Juarez only. So under those conditions, then people just start killing each other for whatever. Someone is, you suspect somebody of you're having an affair with your wife, you can hire some teenager for $100 to blow away, the person you suspect of this. And chances are, if you do that in Juarez, chances are you will not get caught or prosecuted.
We're talking this morning in this hour of Focus with Christian Parenti. We're talking about his new book, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. We'll talk some more in a moment after a short break. This is Focus.
Support comes from the Sea Boat in Champaign with a Southern-style menu featuring the Sea Boat sandwich, two pieces of fish on a wheat bun with lettuce, tomato, and tartar sauce. Also, collard greens, fried okra, cornbread, baked macaroni and cheese, and spaghetti. The Sea Boat on West Kirby across from County Market. Delivery and catering at 351-6200.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon with 10 different topics for you every week. On the program tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour, our guest is Frederick Lynch. He's Associate Professor of Government at Claremont McKenna College. We will talk about a book that he's written. The title is One Nation Under AARP, The Fight Over Medicare, Social Security, and America's Future, that really looks at the tremendous political power that older Americans have in this country. Then also on Thursday, we'll take up the issue of food safety, something that continues to be a big issue from time to time when we have outbreaks of foodborne illness, and it wasn't all that long ago. We had a very serious one in Europe. Our guest for the show Thursday in the 10 o'clock hour, Guy Lonergan. He's a professor in the College of Agricultural Sciences and Natural Resources at Texas Tech University. Again, we're here weekday mornings 10 until noon. You can check on the schedule or listen to past programs by going to our website. That is WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour of focus, our guest is Christian Parenti. He is a contributing editor at The Nation. He is a visiting scholar at City University of New York, has written for a number of publications, Fortune, New York Times, LA Times, Washington Post, London Review of Books. His most recent book, the book we're talking about here this morning, is Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. Nation Books is the publisher. We have a caller here. Others are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Caller is here in Champaign County. Hello.
Hi. I'm wondering, you haven't said anything about Darfur. Is there just too much entangling sorts of discourses about it? Because it seems to me it's a prime candidate for the argument. There are a lot of other factors going on, including the destabilization campaign against Sudan and Blackwater arming the Christian soldiers in the South and all that stuff that never gets talked about. But I'm wondering whether, the Sahara and the line, the increasing Sahara is something you could say about it. I guess it's still in the same tropic arc.
Yeah, I didn't deal with Darfur in part because it was one of the places, it was sort of the prime example of climate-driven violence that others had written about. So, I mean, I opened the book discussing Somalia and Kenya and the region, but the caller's correct that Darfur has a climatological aspect to that crisis. There were pastoralists and farmers who had a sort of symbiotic relationship whereby the pastoralists would transit their herds through the farmers' fields after the harvests, and the animals would eat the remainder of the crop and fertilize the field in the process. And so this worked out fairly well, and the pastoralists were Muslim, and the farmers were Christian. Actually, I think it was the other way around. Sorry about that. And it was when the climate starts to break down and the rains come at different times, the wrong times, and the farmers become more desperate, they can't extend this hospitality to the pastoralists. The pastoralists also are forced out of other places where they might remain waiting for the crops to be harvested and move prematurely into the unharvested fields. And so that economic crisis then becomes this ethnic crisis / religious crisis of North versus South, Muslim versus Christian. And there are other contributing factors in that, but one of the triggers is the disruption in the weather patterns associated with climate change and the stresses that puts on pastoralism and on agriculture.
I'm sure that there were people who would respond to the argument by saying something like, well, you know, there always will be people who turn to violence ultimately to make a living, whether they feel that that is a matter of their survival and it's something they're pushed into doing, or it's something they choose just because it seems like a good alternative, and that you don't really need anything as big as climate change to explain that. And in fact, the other factors would be good enough: easy availability of weapons, and some pressure on local resources to the point where people are going to start thinking about taking their AK-47 and going out and taking whatever it is that they want.
Yes, you could argue that. But then, you know, some pressure on resources, that's where the specificity comes in.
Hmm.
And in this case, what I'm arguing is that increasingly climate change is the driving factor. Yes, there's always been war, but every war has always had historically specific causes and contours. And these wars today increasingly have, among their many causes, a climatological aspect, is what I'm arguing.
Mm-hmm.
So Yeah, it's not that everything is totally new and transformed, but that these are the specific conditions of our moment now, and that climate change really does help explain why and how violence takes place in different places. I mean, an example is India. India has had a guerrilla movement for about 30 years called the Naxalites. It's a collection of Maoist parties that are splitting and reuniting in various forms. They started in West Bengal, up in northeast India, in the district of Darjeeling, named for the tea and vice versa. And for much of the last 40 years, they begin in 69 is when their initial date, they were trapped up in the northeast and sort of stayed in that area. But over the last decade and a half, the Naxalites have moved south and west down along the coast, the eastern coast of India. And you can trace their progression and the progression of a drought, a very bad drought that has gripped eastern India. And the way that the Naxalites follow the drought is that farmers facing drought go into debt, because the other compounding issue here is that since 1991, India has been liberalizing its economy, and this has been associated with high growth rates, though economic liberalization is frequently also associated with low growth rates, as it was in Latin America. But in India, it's been associated with high growth rates, the birth of a billionaire class, and the rise of sort of urban India's business services. But in the countryside, the withdrawal of the state and its various bureaucracies, which were sometimes a fetter on production, but also a support to poor farmers, has meant that farmers can no longer, you know, go to semi-socialist institutions for subsidized fertilizer, subsidized loans, etc. They go to moneylenders in the private market. And the moneylenders, because the environmental crisis is so intense, they don't even want the land, they'll only take crops as collateral. And the only crop that they'll advance money for is one that can't be eaten in an emergency by the farmers. So they advance them money for cotton, increasingly GMO cotton, genetically modified cotton. So the farmers, in the face of the drought, borrow money to grow cotton. The more cotton they grow, the lower the price of cotton, the harder it is to pay the debts. So then they borrow more to grow more cotton, and the cotton is really stripping the soil of its nutrients, and because it requires inputs, Roundup, pesticide, and fertilizer, it requires capital, so the farmers go deeper and deeper into debt. So the drought causes a debt crisis. The debt crisis has been the cause of farmers committing suicide. Across India, estimates are that 200,000 farmers may have killed themselves. In Andhra Pradesh, where I was doing my research, 2,000 farmers have been documented of killing themselves. And in a horribly sort of poetic way, they do this frequently by drinking the pesticides designed for this, drinking Roundup that's designed for this cotton, or vice versa. But other farmers don't commit suicide. They commit themselves to committing political homicide, and they join the Naxalites, who come along into this crisis of the drought, following the drought, as it were, with an alternate explanation for the nature of the problem, and a solution. Real or imagined, you could argue over that how they're going to overthrow the Indian state, they're going to institute land reform, they're going to get rid of moneylenders, and they do, in fact, do that, you know, when they come into areas. They kill the moneylenders. And then, of course, the state responds with counterinsurgency, a special police force called the Greyhounds that sweep northern Andhra Pradesh, killing suspects and interrogating and torturing people just north of Andhra Pradesh in Chhattisgarh, where the issue is that drives the Naxalites is less agricultural and more mining. They've set up a private paramilitary force called the Salvajutam, who are essentially thugs and warlords, a lot of them ex-Naxalites. And the government, the state government, is, in a short term, it looks like, building up a civilian auxiliary force to help it put down this rebellion. But if we look at the history of counterinsurgency, it's setting up future warlords and future bandits by funding the Salvajutam and allowing these private, unaccountable militias to operate. So that's, you know, that's another example of a specific way in which a war now is driven by climate change.
Yeah, I want to ask you if you could talk about another place which is really in the news now, and that's Somalia, which is now regarded to be maybe one of the most dangerous and chaotic places on the face of the planet, with a horrible famine going on there that is exacerbated by political conflict. Tens of thousands of people are thought to have died already. Something like 500,000 children, there's this concern that they may die. And there again, I suppose one could see it as this kind of religious conflict that we've seen other places. Now, you've been there and you've written about this. What is the climate dimension of what's going on in Somalia?
Well, I haven't actually been to Somalia. I mean, a colleague of mine, Jeremy Scahill, went to Somalia. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, one has to pay $2,000 a day for a private security escort of, like, 20 armed men to even visit Mogadishu, and that's the only area that the government has any control, which is propped up as African peacekeeping force. But I've been on the Somali border in Kenya and in Somali areas of Kenya, and I discussed the history of Somalia, like how it collapsed. So, I mean, the way I see this crisis is historical. The famine is the result of the drought. The drought is not the famine. The drought produces conditions that, when met by bad policy, produce famine. And the bad policy in Somalia is essentially no policy. There is no government there. The Muslim guerrillas, the Shabab, that control much of Somalia, banned the major aid organizations because the Western aid organizations were, in their eyes, seen as linked to the U.S.-backed Ethiopian intervention of several years ago. The Ethiopians were in Somalia until 2007 or so. And so the story of that, I mean, how Somalia collapsed, is that in 1969 there was a coup d'etat in Somalia. A dictator, Saeed Barre, comes to the fore. He declares himself a socialist and declares socialism compatible with Islam and the pastoralist lifestyle. The Cubans, who were sort of leading the way into Africa, trying to build alliances, and I think you could argue with the best of intentions, dragging the Soviet Union in there, trying to foment revolution and overthrow what they saw as an evil system, court Somalia. Then at the same time, there's a coup d'etat in Ethiopia, Somalia's arch rival ethnically, and the Cubans also go to support this. It's also a communist coup. They go to support the Ethiopians. Saeed Barre finds out that the Cubans are supporting the Ethiopians, and he switches sides. At the same time, he begins a covert war because, along with being a socialist, he is primarily a Somali irredentist nationalist, and he wants to reunite all Somali-speaking lands. And there are some in Kenya and some in Ethiopia that were not part of Somalia proper. So he launches this war into the Ogaden region of Ethiopia. So you have, for a moment, this strange event of two socialist states fighting each other. But then Saeed Barre, as I said, switched sides, and the U.S. comes to his aid with support from Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. And you could also say, with the best of intentions, Carter supports Saeed Barre because he thinks he's, you know, checking Soviet aggression, that communism is a society that denies people their full civil liberties, that capitalism is a superior economic system, just as Fidel Castro, you know, even according to the CIA, is motivated by the best of intentions. He really believes that socialism is the answer. And so what happens is these two camps of the Cold War pour weapons into the Horn of Africa for 10 years as Ethiopia and Somalia fight and fight. And Saeed Barre will not surrender, will not pull back his troops. And finally, his army collapses, and with it his state, in the first days of January 1991. And ever since then, there has been no functioning government in Somalia. So neither the communist camp nor the capitalist camp set out to destroy Somalia and create a problem of piracy and weapons trafficking and chaos and Muslim fundamentalist guerrillas, which is what the result has been. No one set out to do that, but that was the result of the Cold War engagement, that hot proxy fight in the Horn of Africa, with hundreds of millions of dollars poured in by both sides. And that's really, you know, the deeper underlying reason why there's a famine, because there's no state in Somalia. There can be no policy. There can be no economic development, no even emergency aid relief. And as a result, in the face of this drought, the worst drought in 60 years in the Horn of Africa, which is really a series of droughts. It's basically been, two or three years of drought punctuated by maybe one proper rainy season. And that pattern has been running for over 10 years. And so this has finally reached the point where it means famine on the ground in Somalia, where there's this state of war.
We have about 5-6 minutes left in this hour of focus. Christian Parenti is our guest. He's contributing editor at The Nation, author of the new book, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. Nation Books is the publisher. 333-9455 is our number. Toll free, 800-222-9455. If you want to send us an email, you can do that too. will-talk@illinois.edu. This is perhaps a small piece of this, but since you talked about the fact that one of the issues here is the fact that it seems that the world is just awash in small arms, does anybody have a solution for that?
There have been initiatives to definitely restrict the sale of small arms. I mean, there's nothing commensurate with the problem, but there are national-level programs to control small arms trading. And Victor Bolt, the main arms trader to Africa and to much of the world, has been arrested. So there's a law enforcement response, a piecemeal law enforcement response to try and control the flow of small arms. And we see that here in the U.S. with this, you know, trying to prevent cross-border trafficking of weapons from the U.S. into Mexico. And there was just a big bust. The police force in a town in Columbus, New Mexico, was fired because it turned out that they were actually trafficking weapons into Mexico. So there's that kind of piecemeal effort, but there's no effective international kind of regime of mopping up and shutting down the flow of small arms.
What is to be done then? I suppose that's the ultimate question. What would you say we should be done?
Well, I think that the international negotiations that, you know, trying to come up with a successor agreement to the Kyoto Protocol. Admittedly, the Kyoto Protocol was not that successful. That was the agreement that was signed in the early 90s to try and cut greenhouse gas emissions. And it also involved some adaptation, trying to help states deal with the amount of climate change we're locked in for. By and large, it was not that effective. President Clinton signed the Kyoto Protocol, but it was never ratified by the Senate. There's now an attempt to create a successor agreement that will have more teeth. And unfortunately, the Obama administration, despite having run on the issue of climate change, did not play and has not played a constructive role in those negotiations. But I think a new international treaty is important, and then as part of that treaty, there has to be a fund, and this is part of the discussions, to help transfer capital and technology to the Global South to help with both mitigation and adaptation. And that really the most important thing that has to happen is mitigation. Climate change could become a whole lot worse. It's very clear that there are tipping points after which climate change becomes self-fueling, and we're hitting those tipping points. For example, the melting of the permafrost in the Arctic releases methane that then becomes a self-fueling problem. So we have to reduce carbon emissions here in the North, global North, particularly in the U.S. And despite the sclerotic, broken-down situation in Washington, D.C., there's a lot that can be done, and I outline some of this in the end of the book. For one thing, the EPA has been has the responsibility to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. There are about 30 rules that we're waiting on the EPA to issue. If those rules, for example, you know, pertaining to gas-fired power plants, coal-fired power plants, oil refineries, there's specific sets of rules setting targets for how this is going to be regulated, because this is a new, this is only since 2007 that the EPA has actually been charged with this. If those rules were robust enough, that would really help raise the price of carbon, which would then help shift private investment towards alternative energy. Because as long as dirty energy is cheap and profitable to invest in, then that's where private money is going to go. Once there's an advantage and a desire, a consumer demand to switch to clean energy, which can be helped by this regulation that would essentially be a de facto carbon tax, that will help drive money into creating alternative clean energy. The other thing the government can do, and this is without allocating any more money or getting new legislation, is it can use its purchasing power to help kickstart the clean tech sector, because the clean tech sector really needs markets at this point. And if it has large enough markets, it will achieve economies of scale, and it can lower the cost on things like electric cars and clean electricity. And once the price for those commodities becomes competitive with the dirty alternative, then the private sector will start making the switch for economic reasons. So the federal government plus all of the state governments constitutes about one-third of the U.S. GDP. Public sector is going to buy lots of electricity and buy vehicles. Might as well use that money to buy green solutions and help in the process do two things: reduce the public sector, the government sector's carbon footprint directly, but then also create economies of scale for the burgeoning clean tech sector so that they can lower the cost of production, lower the cost of what they're selling, and therefore become more appealing to the mass private sector market. And once you see the price gap between electricity from coal and electricity from solar and wind, once you see that price gap close, then the private sector will start moving towards clean technology much more robustly than it is now. And so federal government has 450,000 mostly large office buildings that are very wasteful. If they were all retrofitted and if it bought clean power for them, that would be good in and of itself, and it would really do a lot to help this transformation and help us reduce carbon emissions. It's going to spend money on vehicles, on electricity anyway. Might as well do that in a green fashion. And to Obama's credit, he did issue an executive order urging or ordering federal agencies to begin plans to do this sort of thing, but due to pushback from the right, that has been delayed and not engaged in robustly enough. So there are these two tools on the table: EPA regulation, the big green buy, both of which could be embraced much more robustly than they are, because the science is clear. We have to start making reductions in our carbon emissions starting now, and they have to come down very precipitously by about 80% over the next 2 to 3 decades, or we are definitely going to hit these tipping points, and the problem is going to get much, much worse.
All right, there we'll have to leave it. If you want to read more, the book is Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. Nation Books is the publisher. Christian Parenti is the author. He's contributing editor at The Nation. And Mr. Parenti, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on the show.